Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Burning down the house here on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Yes, that was Gimme Shelter, because we're going to talk about shelter. Funny, an architecture show where we talk about shelter. Enough of the theory that we've been talking about more recently. Today I want to speak with David Bergman, who's the author of Sustainable Design, A Critical Guide, which is recently published by the Princeton Architectural Press. Say hello, David.
Hello.
Hi, I'm so glad that you could join us. If you hear in the background there's all sorts of thumpery going on, that is because we broadcast live from the Garden of Roberta's in Bushwick, and they're having Tiki Beach Party again. And it's jumping here at 261 Moore Street in the East Williamsburg Industrial Park. So in no particular order, I want to set out the topics that I want to talk about. But because, as you know, this is a conversation among and between architects and designers, not an interview. Mm-hmm. Heavens, no. We're likely to wander off in almost any direction. I want to talk about a little bit about, I want to know your own background. Mm-hmm. This is a really interesting compendium of everything that all of us who are mindful of good green practices deal with on a day-to-day basis. What's your background in terms of getting your head into this kind of information? We'll find out. I mean, do you have an undergraduate degree in physics or environmental science or anything like that? I want to talk about some of the things that you address in your book. Mm-hmm. And I'm especially interested in the directions that you see our practice going into now that good green is becoming the new normal. Okay?
Yeah.
So let's take a little minute or so of musical break. All right. Curtis B. Wayne, I'm Burning Down the House. I'm here with David Bergman. And, well, tell us a little bit about your background. You are an architect.
I am an architect. Have been for a fair number of years, I guess. And you're asking about how my background was.
Yeah, how'd you get into this? In my case, I had a cousin who was a student of Bucky Fuller, so I knew about all that synergistic stuff from a very mm-hmm. early age, and had all of the Spaceship Earth manuals that the students there at Southern Illinois University had published, the ones in the gray paper, mm-hmm. Which I've lost over the years.
Well, that's a shame.
But yeah, actually, they were kind of crummy books. Anyway, what about you?
I can't say I go as far back as having learned from Bucky Fuller, unfortunately, but I think my eco interests were sort of in the late 60s, 70s. That was my high school, college range of time. Uh-huh. And it was the typical high school things of having an ecology club and the newspaper drives and the things like that.
An ecology club.
Yeah, which I think I was president of, if I recall correctly,
cool.
But who knows. So it wasn't exactly architectural types of, uh-huh. of environmental. And
I bet there were girls involved.
Yeah. Hippies.
That's how I got into
post hippies.
That's how I got into folk music. You know, there are all these sort of post beat type girls hanging out with their guitars, and I didn't mind singing Puff the Magic Dragon if I got to hang out with girls.
I think I was a little more of a geek, but
okay,
but that's all right. And that carried a little bit into college, where I did architecture undergraduate, but I also did economics. Almost by accident.
Very cool.
I wanted to major in urban design and city planning, uh-huh. and got to college and discovered they'd canceled the major.
Where was this?
This was at Yale.
Uh-huh.
And so that I consequently figured, okay, I'll do some economics and some architecture, which I had wanted to do anyway, the uh-huh. architecture. And
yeah,
they combined together somehow into that. And it actually turned out to be fortuitous for the things I'm working on now, which maybe we'll talk about in a little while. Then got out into the architecture world after graduate school, and there was very little, I'm sure you recall this period, there's very little going on in the way of green design, green architecture, or environmentalism, for that matter.
Yeah, it was... of course, I read every issue of the Whole Earth catalog, mm-hmm. you know, cover to cover, because it was fascinating stuff. But by the early 80s...
That's what I'm talking... Or even mid-late 80s, yeah.
Certainly by the late 70s, mm-hmm. all of that was seen as an interesting passing fancy.
Yeah,
and serious architects were not paying any attention to that.
And maybe
whatsoever.
Not too much emphasis on the fancy part of fancy.
yeah, just a fad.
Yeah.
Although my own bachelor thesis project at Cooper Union. Because I have been deeply steeped in physical science, featured an inflatable canopy, and the composition of which I imagined, and this was 1975, would be covered with flexible photovoltaics.
Neat.
Which, at that time...
Yeah, who heard that?
Was something you could only dream of, but it seemed to me that... Eventually, somebody would figure out how to do that, and it would be a cool idea to have a sort of a roof above the roof that could collect some power that you could use for whatever.
See, that whole kind of thinking wasn't anywhere on the radar in my graduate school or in the years afterward. We're talking a few years later. I got my MArch in 81, uh-huh. And that was...
Is that at Yale also?
No, that was Princeton.
Uh-huh. I thought that was a doctoral MAUD sort of...
They have a doctoral program there. I was in the MArch.
Oh, okay.
So just immediate grad.
So you were doing battle with Mr. Graves.
Uh-huh. Yep. It was very much about postmodernism and the rationalists and all that.
Mm.
And very much theory-oriented and zero emphasis on anything ecological or environmental.
Well, of course. I mean, because, one, it wasn't seen as architecture.
Right.
Two, many of the formalists, and Graves is a formalist.
Oh, absolutely.
how the mechanical systems work are of no interest whatsoever. As Philip Johnson once famously, and I actually heard him say this, I know that the toilet flushes, but I don't care to know how it flushes.
Right.
That's for the engineers to worry about. which is fine, but my I don't have any particular animosity towards Philip, except really when you look at his work, he's a decorator.
Yeah.
And... or was.
Right.
And to a certain extent, Michael Graves is a decorator or ornamentalist.
That's right. And he has a painting background that you can see very obviously in the work.
Yeah, I had it out with him when he came as a visiting critic once at Harvard Design School.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that we could agree on was that we both really admired T.A. Below.
Okay.
Other than that, it was a famously bad student-critic interaction that went on.
I did feel a little bit of fish out of water at Princeton at the time. I actually went there because I felt I didn't understand what postmodernism was, and I didn't understand the new directions that Graves and others were going in. I figured this was the way to find out.
What's your conclusion?
That I pretty much rejected it. You know, I agree with you on the decoration side of things, and it didn't have any of the relevance that I was looking for. I didn't quite know at the time that it was relevance that was the problem. Until, you know, a bunch of years later when I started practicing and realized, well, you know, architecture can be beautiful and it could be high theory and have all these other purposes, but in the end, it really wasn't doing anything that I felt was really important.
Right. And one of the recurrent themes that I like to bring up, in which I did in the program that was aired last Sunday, David Chipperfield, this year's Biennale director, has yet again restated the persistent notion that if we only talk about what architecture looks like, then we're just decorators, instead of what does it do in a broader sense for society. Which gets us around to eco-design.
There you go.
To my mind, this is the best thing that's happened to our profession in at least 50 years. Because integrating all of these concerns into the built environment requires people with exactly the kind of huge ability to handle disparate information that the training of an architect requires.
It's a bringing back the Renaissance man idea or Renaissance person, I guess I should say, idea of architecture.
And without any sense of, on one hand, irony, nor on the other hand, any sense of hubris, the reason I think that a lot of us like being architects is we like to dabble with all of these different things.
And sometimes we even think we know what we're doing.
And sometimes, well, that's why it's called practice. Because once it becomes a recipe, then where's the fun in that?
Right. The invention.
So you started out as a self-professed sort of geeky guy, interested in ecology. I understand that. I mean, who doesn't enjoy going to a Pete Seeger Sloop Clearwater party, right?
And there I was, raised on the Hudson River, so I was there.
Uh-huh. Did you ever get to sail on the Clearwater?
I didn't. One of my sisters crewed on it for a while, though.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. So where in the Hudson Valley?
I grew up in Rockland County.
And that's on the west side?
Across from Westchester, yeah.
Okay. To any extent, I mean, Rockland County's got, I mean, towns and stuff, but then there's also farmland not so far from
the
Hudson.
When my family moved there and after I was born, late 50s, it was a lot of conversion of farmland going on. We were watching orchards being plowed under, basically, and we'd go, you know, pick the fruit on the last season of the orchard before it was going to be a development the next spring. Most of Rockland County basically is the typical suburban bedroom community.
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm hearing, it's not because you grew up, in a semi-rural area and you really, had a sense of the earth or anything. You're coming at this more from a kind of a geeky, I like to play with hardware kind of approach.
Like to play with hardware.
I mean, there's a lot of hardware in your book here. You've got, and it's excellently done.
Thanks.
I do want to get into some questions about why you've included certain factoids and left out some others.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time concentrating today because of the
Our background,
because of the mosh pit that's on the other side of this tin can. Could we have another little musical break, please? Thank you, Joe.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
We're burning down the house on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, speaking with David Bergman, who's Princeton Yalie. Wow.
Yeah.
The air must be very thin up there.
Oh, man.
It's okay. I went to Harvard. But I was mad. I was mad to go to Yale.
And Cooper's not too mad either.
It used to be a good school. We'll see what happens in the future after Veedler retires.
Ah, former Princeton.
Yeah, that whole gang. you know, for those of you who are younger colleagues or civilians, for a period of time in New York City, there was the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies, and some very interesting characters were involved in that. The director was Peter Eisenman, who taught me a great amount of theory. He was just starting his teaching career, and he came to Cooper, and he did a course 2 years running, which I took both years, and it was an evolving, pretty much a conversation, Peter with himself.
Yeah,
putting up slides, talking about buildings that he admired and why.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the buildings that he admired were by Jim Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at some of Sterling's stuff in a good green design point of view, actually they're pretty good buildings, and they perform fairly well.
Yeah.
That one center in Leicester, where there's brick and then there's glass, and the glass does interesting rhomboidal things, and so there's a, as Eisenman would say, there's a topological topological inversion between what we perceive as being nominally glazed and nominatively a masonry.
The wonderful archy speak.
And I could do that shit all day long, but I prefer not to, because I think it does a really bad service, or rather, a very good disservice to our profession, because it makes us inscrutable to our would-be clients. now, back to your book.
Okay.
I mean, you include some really good stuff in here, like, for example, you talk about light, and that warmer light is actually cooler, because the hotter you heat the...
In terms of the color temperature, yeah.
In terms of degree Kelvin,
right.
A warmer light actually is cooler, and a colder light is actually hotter.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's good information to have included in here.
A little specific.
Did you write this intentionally to be a textbook for your students?
It's intended to be somewhere in between a text and something that architects or designers who weren't schooled in this and wanted to get into or could read, but also a book that lay people could read. I purposely avoided a lot of the jargon, that the type of
language. And I think that's good, and I think it serves you quite well, because it seems to me to be very accessible, and I think
Excellent.
That's really great.
That
it's
goal.
Also really, it's a really nice looking book, and the paper is, you know, feels good,
and it is recycled.
Is it recycled content paper? That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to really take too much issue with anything that you've got in here.
No, it's okay.
Except for your gray water diagram shows gray water going into your clothes washer, which I think is a really...
Does it show that?
Yeah.
It also shows the water coming out of the clothes washer.
I think it shows it going in. Maybe
I'll have to take a little look at that.
Maybe you know where that is better than I.
I actually had two of those diagrams.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Laurie Greenberg. Greenberg. I art directed all the images in the book, and I'm David's design partner and also the wife. And we did have two images, different Greywater images, so I just wanted to point that out. But David's looking it up now to double check.
I'll find it.
I mean, we wouldn't want to do that. Now, for those of you who are civilians, Greywater is the water that comes out of a lavatory, that is a hand sink, or out of your tub or your shower. Black water is the stuff that comes out of your water closet. In other words, your toilet or a urinal. There is, in many parts of the country, a movement to use gray water. Again, in a domestic setting, in New York City, we're not allowed to do that. You can use gray water after it's been treated for flushing toilets. Matter of fact, down in Battery Park City, the new buildings all have black water treatment systems. But again, that water, even though when it comes out, it is potable, they're not allowed to use it for anything other than irrigation or flushing toilets.
Yeah, I think in some municipalities, perhaps you are allowed to use it for something like clothes washing. The idea is that the heated water is taking care of some of it, but more likely the detergent is. The main point, of course, you can't use gray water for anything potable.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to wash my clothes in water that wasn't potable.
A lot of people do, when you think about it.
Yes, yeah. Out there in the world, a lot of people are actually cooking with water that's
another issue.
That's tainted,
yeah,
which is unfortunate. I mean, one of the things you don't get into here is the emerging world of treating water supply in the highest quality of good green practice. And the office where I'm working right now, in our residential developments, always we include water filtration. We'll have 2-micron water filters.
For the incoming potable water?
For everything.
Mm-hmm.
Just at the main water supply coming into the building, which perhaps might seem a bit over the top, considering that the quality of water in New York City is really pretty
good. I was going to say, New York wouldn't seem to need that.
It seems to be a great draw.
Hmm.
Now, what's your perception about people finding these eco, or I like to call it good green, practices being desirable in new construction?
You're talking about clients and lay people. It really depends on where they're coming from. And I'm sure you find this too. Clients may come to you asking for something green and not really know what it is that they want, or they may want something very, very specific.
Yeah.
You know, they might be specifically concerned with health inside the house.
Right.
Or with their heating budget.
Right. Certainly, interior air quality, or IAQ, is a biggie, especially since increasingly people have asthma and other chemical toxic problems. And a lot of the modern materials that we had in the 70s and 80s were actually rather toxic.
That, and you combine it with the fact that we made our buildings tighter in terms of infiltration so that there was an air circulation to dilute that toxicity.
Correct.
It made it pretty nasty. I just wrote a piece last week for greenbiz.com looking at indoor air quality, or actually I should say indoor environmental quality, and business costs. And
interesting.
A lot of studies have been finding that it's good for business in terms of their overhead, their labor costs, to improve indoor environmental conditions because the staff is more productive, they're healthier, less turnover, happier, all kinds of great things that come from having more productivity because of that indoor quality.
Have you read this study by Terrapin Bright Green, The Economics of Biophilia?
I've read pieces of it, yeah.
I can arrange for you to get a copy.
That would be nice.
In that study, they looked at real case studies from businesses and from healthcare institutions demonstrating the gains in productivity or the shortening of recovery times in hospitals, which is a wonderful thing because now there's a sound economic sense of doing these good green things actually has an economic benefit.
Yeah, just the idea that patients in a hospital recover faster if they have a view of nature.
Isn't that
through
something?
That window is kind of amazing.
Right, and looking at a painting or a photograph of nature doesn't work.
No,
got to be the real
cheat.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm encouraged by the regulations that exist in other countries. Like, for example, in Germany, in an office building, you have to be within 7 meters, or about 22 feet,
right,
of a window.
Yeah, they have a whole different floor plate design of towers because of that.
Right, so they end up with much narrower towers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they don't have the kind of density that we have in Manhattan. I mean, they have floor area ratios that are perhaps 8 to 10.
Right.
And now we're looking at city planning here in New York City, looking at FARs of 21.6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In commercial or residential too?
In Midtown
for
office occupancies.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're going to build that high, you almost have to start from a large floor plate.
Well, you do, because of the vertical transportation demands for a tower.
Yeah.
Where the elevator core is enormous.
Right.
If you look at the floor plate of the Empire State Building, it's almost all elevator.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is, and this is something that eventually I think we in the profession will discover, what is the optimal density of development between the trade-off between vertical transportation requirements and usable floor area.
But also in terms of well-being in general, and if you take that from commercial construction, like Midtown, into the realm of residential, I mean, what is the optimal density? There's a lot of discussion these days about transit-oriented development,
right,
and that we want to cluster people around where the transportation exists, and it's sort of a feeling of the denser, the better. But there is a limit.
Yes, there is, but it is possible to incorporate biophilic areas or events, mm-hmm, even into a tower. If you look at the Singapore architects, Woha,
mm-hmm,
you know about them?
A little bit.
They do towers where they carve divots of the mass.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there'd be a garden area way up in the air.
Right.
You know, every 3 or 4 floors, so that you're either looking out at the ground plane of this sky garden, or you're looking at the trunks of the trees, or you're looking at the crown of the tree.
Right.
And then it repeats again.
But you're not going to see that in a place like New York City, where that's cost per square foot.
We might see that in New York City if it's mandated as a part of the, let's say, the carrot, will let you upzone to maybe as much as FAR of 26, but you might, therefore, and we'll see how this plays out. I happen to know people who are working on drafting the legislation. They think that it should require that there be biophilic features, which would be very good, especially in Midtown, where there's no green space. I mean, the Westpocket parks of the 1970s are pathetic. You know, the little tiny park, like Paley Park,
and
there might be a waterfall, but everything else is cobbles, and those are very unpleasant spaces.
Yeah. Down in our neighborhood, we live in the Lower East Side, and we've had, since we moved into our building many, many years ago, a slot of a view out to a small park. And now that lot, that open slot, has been purchased, and someone's talking about building in there, and we're thinking, we're going to lose the only views we had of nature
from
our apartment. Yeah, I
know. It's unfortunate. I know. Even a building that conforms to the building code doesn't necessarily get you any kind of, even a view of the sky. I mean,
right,
I live in a ground floor apartment in the back of an apartment house, and I have a view of other people's brick walls. I can't even see if the weather's good or not.
Yes, exactly.
Because I'm 20 stories down in a slot that goes to the
Well, that's
the
what the Weather Channel's for.
I don't have television.
Internet. Do it that way.
I have the internet, but I have to go out and stand in front of the building to know where the weather is. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But that's Manhattan.
Right, which is a creature unto itself.
Absolutely. I mean, I made my choice. I lived in a very quaint part of coastal Connecticut for almost 20 years, But it was, I there was no reason for me to be there. It was boring, and furthermore, the economy was terrible out there for an architect.
Well, I beat it out of Rockland County pretty quickly too.
Yeah, and you know, and I spent my Wonder Bread years down in Jersey, and some people just like living down there, but for an architect, you have to be where the clients are, and that means you have to be in a fairly dense city.
But does that mean you're in New York City by economic choice or more by personal cultural?
It's both.
Yeah,
economic choice and also absolutely cultural.
Yeah,
it's a place to be. I mean, it's where things are happening.
Right.
Quiet, of course, is a very important thing. You didn't talk too much. I don't know if you talked about acoustics at all, which is a piece of the pie of quality of life. I mean, to me, all of these considerations. Noise is addressed in the building code, but conformance with that is spotty.
Yeah.
We have a requirement from the New York State multiple dwelling law that there should be an impact isolation of a certain rating so you don't hear people walking around or dropping things upstairs. It still happens, but we're more likely to pay attention to it now than ever before. It's always been in there, but people didn't really pay much attention to it. That's a piece of good environmental design. These technologies that you write about, I'm glad that you put this book together because it's a great education in all the different aspects of things that we're all talking about these days.
I was trying to pull all the pieces together.
Right. And there are a lot of pieces.
And you had a set number of pages, too.
Well, that was another... Yeah.
Another limitation.
Well, it's part of a series from Princeton Architectural Press called Architecture Briefs.
Uh-huh.
And so it was necessarily brief. They were all the same length, number of pages. So it was difficult to get everything in there or as much in there as I wanted to.
Uh-huh.
And I hadn't thought about it too much, but you're right, acoustics should be in there someplace.
Possibly. Although it's not an exactly an emerging thing. It's something that's been pretty well understood for over 100 years.
Right.
Let's take another little break, and we'll come back and talk about the new normal.
Great.
That, of course, is Dave Brubeck, classic take five. We're not going to take five. We're only going to take one here. We're here with David Bergman, author of...
Sustainable Design, a Critical Guide.
And I understand you have a blog. Is that correct?
I do. A blog I launched, two or three months ago, called Eco-Optimism.
Eco-Optimism.
Yeah.
That's better than eco-depression, I suppose.
Well, yeah. And that's...
Eco-glumness.
And I think a lot of us are stuck in eco-depression and glumness, which was part of the reason for pursuing this idea of eco-optimism. And showing... The point of eco-optimism that I'm trying to drive home is that we have certainly a slew of problems. Environmental problems, that would be the ecological problems. We also have a slew of economic problems. So that's the other part of the eco in the eco-optimism. And the idea that I'm trying to work on to get across is that we can address both of those sets of problems, the ecological and the economic ones, at the same time that they are actually have complementary resolutions. They aren't fighting each other. You know, we don't have to trade off economy for ecology. And that furthermore, when we work on these complementary resolutions, that will let us end up in a place where we're better off than we started. So it's not just a matter simply of reaching that word we all love to throw around, sustainability, but getting beyond sustaining ourselves, where we can actually flourish, become better people, better communities, so that this can all be, as problematic as it is right now, this can all be for the good if we pursue this right.
Oh, sure. I see that. Well, where we're sitting right here is, in many ways, one of the seminal environments, shall we say, of like-minded people that have gone and started the Brooklyn Grange. On top of our studio is a greenhouse.
Yeah.
One of the first rooftop greenhouses actually producing edible stuff in the city. Back in the 70s, there was a rooftop greenhouse that kept indoor plants.
And you might point out, your listeners don't know, this is a rooftop of a shipping container.
Yeah. Yes, these are two evergreen shipping lines, shipping containers, the same shipping company that lost containers containing 28,000 rubber ducks.
Oh, gosh. I didn't realize that one.
These are not those containers, but right. they are just like those containers that were swept overboard in the North Pacific in 1992. I just finished reading Moby Duck, the story of the man who tried to track down the drift pattern of those 28,000 rubber ducks. Mm-hmm. And there were also a couple of other animals that were part of this set
flotilla.
Of four.
Yeah.
He found a few of them in Alaska. Some people reported that they thought they saw some in Kennebunk in Maine, but he was never able to actually substantiate that. But he went all over the planet looking for
the residue
of the rubber ducks. And along the way, of course, he talked with people about the great North Pacific gyre, the huge mass of the sort of Sargasso Sea of plastic detritus that's floating around. Which is not just consumer plastic, but it's also bits of fishing nets and all kinds of stuff that just accumulates. But what I wanted to say was that what seems to be emerging is a higher level of awareness of many different aspects of our environment, of the planetary environment, of the way that we choose to live, of the quality of the food that we eat, which then is good for us as architects, because then people start to have the wherewithal to ask us the right questions about how it is that we are, in fact, improving the quality of life in the built environment. So I see this all of his piece, the desire to have better quality food has led to the development of urban farms, which at the same time has the potential of saving the city if there was a disruption in food supply.
Oh, okay. So you're going into the post-apocalyptic.
Well, no, I mean, but food security is a very huge issue.
Right.
There is only 3 days of food on the shelves in New York City.
Right.
If something would happen to transportation, it's very good to know that there is some food within the five boroughs.
Yeah, and we do have to be able to cope with emergencies. I think the big question there, the bigger question might be, do we need to look at this from a occasional emergency point of view, or from a long term new situation?
Well, that's a question that no one really has an answer to, because about a month ago I had a conversation with Jim Kunstler, who's the leading gloom and doom.
Absolutely.
When the oil runs out, civilization as we know it stops. I myself don't think that cars are going to go away.
No.
I think that's unfortunate, but I just don't see that they're going to go away, because it's impossible for people to continue to live in most of North America if they don't have cars.
No. I think what we will see, and this is maybe the eco-optimist side of it again, is a transition in which people will look less toward living in those car-dependent regions. You know, the suburb, not so much exurb, but the suburbs where you have no choice, you know,
right.
the kinds of area I grew up in. But it's not going to happen overnight. We can't change our commuting and transportation systems overnight, nor do we really want to, because what are you going to do with all that building stock?
Oh, we talked about it a little bit about that. I mean, you can certainly start dismantling suburbia.
Right.
I mean, there's a great stock of building materials that have already been produced if you take apart the houses rather than just breaking them.
Right. I have this vision of what would happen if we could, you know, helicopter lift the houses and subdivisions and sort of put them all a little closer together toward the village centers and then have the farms where the houses used to be. But that's, you know.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I mean, houses can be moved.
Yeah. No, well, not the big ones we have, but.
Well, I mean, the recent ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, but most of those are shit anyway.
That's true.
I mean, they're very crummy. I mean, they may have a lot of volume, but they're crummy buildings. And
right. So what is going to be their lifespan?
Probably 40 years or less.
Right. So that may be the window of the transition period.
So a house that was built in the mid-90s means it's going to be done by the mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. Good use of materials.
Well, trends are very interesting. I have grown adult children, and they live in urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interested in living in suburbia.
Been reading a lot about that lately.
And I think that's a very interesting phenomenon. And I think that, a lot of the issues that you bring up in your book, you can plug the book again if you like.
Sustainable Zion, A Critical Guide, one?
Yes, by Princeton Architectural Press.
That's
because sometimes people drop in on these programs
gotcha.
In the middle. To the extent that we as architects master all of these strategies, then these strategies next inform our design thinking. So right now, a building that's really good in terms of use of resources is likely to look like, and I don't like to talk about formalistic stuff too much, on this program, but it's going to tend to look like the gadgets that we had to use in order to save energy.
Right.
It's going to if it's an office building, for example, it's likely to have only 40% of vision glass, because any more than that, and you're going to have a much larger cooling problem.
Yeah, a big greenhouse.
Or worse, a solar collector.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely to have some sort of louver system offering passive solar shading to an area that is also then harvesting daylight. It is likely to have a vegetative roof for a variety of reasons. One is to reduce solar insolation, that is to say the incoming solar energy, and two, it's to absorb rainwater,
mm-hmm.
Which we're trying to not dump into our sewers. It is likely to have an orientation that minimizes solar gain. I mean, so
all of which is good.
All of which is good, but all of which drive formalistic responses so that buildings look a certain way because of the technology that we're using.
Right, so what you're getting at is there an aesthetic of green design?
Well, right now there is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we look historically to previous centuries, there were fairly large buildings that were done with steel and masonry that had punched openings that actually performed very well in terms of heating and cooling, because necessarily they had to.
Right. Right.
They were built before the invention of air conditioning. So they were built with the intention that there would be awnings in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
which nobody does awnings anymore. I don't know why. I mean, I think they're, you know, fantastic. They're cheap. They work. You put an awning out, you open a window, you get mm-hmm. cross ventilation. It's not so bad.
Just don't make it out of vinyl.
Well, no, we wouldn't want to make it out of vinyl, because vinyl is a petroleum product, and there's only
That's
so much oil.
Mm-hmm. So I think a little bit of what you're getting at, so there's a broader picture of that, which I begin to address in the conclusion of the book, which is looking at where what the role of aesthetics has been in green design, and along with that, what the role of nature or relationship to nature has been.
Yeah.
And I have a sequence in there that begins with design as usual, which could either mean the pre-industrial age period of design or the very beginnings of that. But the main point is that it was an era in which we still had to design within the constraints of nature. We hadn't yet made the engines and the materials and the air conditioning systems, etc.,
right,
that let us think we were better than nature. Then in the 60s, 70s era, we got into a period that I've labeled in here green design as unusual, because we began to start thinking about green design, but it was really bizarre-looking stuff very often.
Oh, yeah. Well, a geodesic dome, for example.
Right, or an earthship.
Yes. Right, the adobe earthships out in the desert.
With rubber tires in their walls.
Right, which is an interesting idea. It's almost... like in cooking, there's a sort of cucina povera, which is, poor people's cooking. An earthship is sort of like, well, let's see what we can build and not spend any money.
Right, which is a perfectly valid way to approach it, but it's something that looks very, very different from what most people think of as a home or a building.
Right.
And so it wasn't going to appeal to any kind of mainstream.
Right.
And that, so from this green design is unusual, we've moved into where I think we are now, which is green design as usual, meaning that it's becoming more integrally incorporated in some senses into design. It doesn't stand out as being so bizarre looking anymore.
Right.
But we, as in our architects and designers, I think most of us, too many of us, still approach it as this added on area of focus where we're going to do a building and, oh yeah, we're going to make it green. So what I'm positing in this sequence is that after green design as usual, we're on the cusp of moving back into something that I would call, again, design as usual, in that the green design part is just an integral assumed part of design, and you can't even necessarily tell it's there.
Right. As in, for example, the traditional Charleston, South Carolina house.
Great example, yeah.
Has a piazza, on which we would call a porch here in the north, on every floor on the south-facing side.
I think I actually used that as an example at one point in there of when we were working within the constraints of nature, how we were doing it.
Right, which eventually we're going to have to do, because it is likely that there is a practical limit to how much electricity we can generate.
But you said, look, likely we're going to have to do it, but I'd like to change that slightly into something that we want to do.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Because I think that's a big difference.
That's interesting. I mean, because I'm a bit of a history buff, and so I've been looking into the history of electricity and electrical illumination. And in the beginning, if you wanted electrical light, it meant you had your own dynamo in the basement of your building, which... the Edison Company would install for you, and then you had to run your own generating plant because there was no grid. So buildings that had electrical illumination had a little dynamo in the bit. Now we've come around to discover that the loss of energy in the electrical grid is so great that, in fact, if you look at the amount of energy it takes to produce a certain amount of kilowatts of electricity, the best way to do it is the way it was originally done, by generating on your own site.
Local distributed power.
Yes.
Yeah. I've actually had some discussions with people who know more about this particular aspect than I, and strangely enough, I've been told that the power loss factor by some people is not that great, and that the loss of efficiency when going to these smaller distributed plants doesn't make up for it.
I asked one of the senior engineers from Cozentini.
Well, that would be a good source, yeah.
Yeah, and I posed that exact question. I said, yes, I understand that there are energy losses in the grid, but I also understand that a larger generator is better than a smaller generator because of the back EMF and hysteresis loss in a smaller device. And he said, well, actually, it's not that great in a smaller device. You actually have your physics backwards, and that the losses in the grid are much higher, and it's much more energy efficient, especially then if you're capturing the heat from your generator and you're using it for other purposes, especially in a residential application where you have co-generation.
I think that sort of exemplifies one of the frustrations in eco-design, environmentalism in general, is that we seem to have a lot of experts, and I'm not criticizing their expertise, but they contradict each other.
Oh, yeah.
And how are we to figure out what really is the right way to do something?
I like to tell my kids in the office, there's no one right way, but there are many wrong ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just try to avoid one of the wrong ways and then, you know, pick one of the right ways and get on with it.
David, it also kind of goes with your answer to many questions, which is, it depends.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for reminding you. Students ask me questions like these, and that is commonly what I say. Well, it depends on which variables we have at play here.
Yes.
And there's a lot of it depends answers.
Yeah, of course. And when I have conversations with clients and they want something, I'll say yes, but...
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
There's always the yes, but. I hate to say no.
Right.
Most of the time, I don't actually get put on the spot with that sort of question anymore, which is good. I let other people suffer with the no, you can't do that.
Well, I've been emailing with a friend recently about the topic of can we get our energy through wind turbines?
No.
And there's articles that have come out.
No.
Well, there are a whole bunch.
I know the answer to that. Well, that's not possible.
He agrees with you, but I've been seeing all these posts recently that are talking about how much land area we have available, how much we can generate, mm-hmm. and you know that we can indeed do it. And then I hear others, also experts in the field, that say no, we can't use that much land area; it's physically impossible.
Presently, it is believed that there's not enough wind to be converted into electrical power. And on the other downside is that the industrial infrastructure necessary to generate these ginormous wind turbines could be better used doing something else. I mean, you know, one of those 50-megawatt wind turbines...
Yeah. It's a lot of material.
Takes a lot of energy to produce it. Is a long payback period. I'm glad that you did talk about life cycle analysis in your book. That's an important thing.
That's actually a big area that I'm working in these days, teaching a course in life cycle analysis.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the life cycle analysis of a photovoltaic array, mm-hmm. you see that it doesn't really start to pay back the energy it was required to create it in the first place for a long time. And we don't know what the true full estimated useful life, or EUL, of a PV array actually is.
They actually seem to be outliving their predictions, is what I've read.
Yes, they are. The original engineers at Bell Telephone thought they would be good for maybe 40 years, and some of those original photovoltaics are still going at 50-plus years.
But the neat thing about an example like that is with a PV panel, once you've built it, you've sort of incurred all of the life cycle costs. There is no incoming, ongoing fuel.
Sure, yet. And that's one of the arguments against even touching embodied energy, because they just say, well, it's a sunk cost. Okay, right. I mean, it's like, okay, you went and you had a wonderful dinner, you had your experience, you paid the check, it's paid for, it's done, it's a sunk cost. Don't start amortizing last night's dinner.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, there's validity to that, but you do have to look at the total cost over time.
Well, from an accounting point of view, yes. But who says that we have to account for everything?
Well, that gets into, you know, Mike, the economic side of what I'm working in these days.
Yes.
And that's that great topic, which I'm sure you've talked about, of externalities, those costs that aren't paid by the party that is creating the costs?
No, we haven't really gotten into that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's
but you could come back and we could talk about all that other stuff.
Okay.
Again, I don't think we have enough time to get into that. But I would love to talk about issues of policy and, for example, even in this political campaign, I'm sure they're going to talk about the cost of gasoline. Well, the cost of gasoline is just a fraction of the cost of transportation. There's the highways and the subsidies to the car makers and all of the materials producers, and then all the cost of cleaning up the atmosphere because of the coal plants.
Which is what those externalities are.
Yes, exactly. Which I would love to talk about.
Yeah.
I've been doing research into embodied energy, and I've discovered that actually nobody has any idea how much embodied energy is actually in a building anymore, although they're working on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was a study that was done by Richard Stein and Bruce Hannon in 1976, which was codified in a report that they issued in 79 and cleaned up and restated in a handbook for the Department of Energy in 1981. And they got they put together embodied energy averages based on data that they got from the Department of Commerce, which went back into the 1960s, to come up with an energy value. For example, so for an office building, about 1.6 million BTUs of energy per square foot. And that was pretty good data for 1967 information. There has been no American study done since then. We don't know how much our buildings weigh. Now, that's one of Bucky's thing. You know, how much does your building weigh? My geodesic dome weighs practically nothing. I can enclose so many cubic meters of space with very little material, whereas your, comparable conventional structure is very heavy and therefore inefficient from a structural point of view. We don't know. We're not tracking this data.
It's a lot like the complications of LCA as well. Figuring out the embodied energy of just a simple material.
Yeah.
As in, figuring out the LCA of that material as well. They're somewhat parallel. Is hard enough. How do you decide what you're going to include as the inputs into the embodied energy or the inputs into the LCA?
Mm-hmm.
Now, take that for material, multiply that into products, many materials that comprise a product, and now take a building, which is a bunch of products put together, and you've many, many fold complicated the equation.
Yes. I mean, it's therefore, it's a very difficult topic to address, although it's a good topic.
It's
a difficult topic to address without real data, because otherwise it's all opinion.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we're trying to get at with LCA, well, the people who are working at it especially. One of the things that we have to get past in the environmental and the eco-design movement is this seat-of-the-pants aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
That we have to be able to say concretely, no pun intended, that this has less of an environmental impact than that, and we know it because of this.
Yeah, we have to have real data.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, what are we talking? We're talking theology otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
Time has gone really, really fast. We're just about to the end of our allotted time slot. This has been really great. I would like you to come back. I would
love
like to talk about LCA and all these externalities and the economics of architecture, because again, one of the things that a conversation about the built environment requires is considering all of these aspects.
Right.
What it looks like is just one small part, and I think that this is just a wonderful opportunity for us as architects, because of our training and because of our wide range of interests.
Yeah, we have the ability to redefine what architecture is and what architects do.
Yes.
What our roles are.
Right. I think we're the masters of the built environment.
If we may say so ourselves.
Because there's no one else who can be.
Perhaps, yeah.
I mean, just because he's got a checkbook doesn't make Donald Trump the master of the built environment. He's a catalyzer, he's or a fertilizer, shall we say. All right, this has been really a lot of fun speaking with David Bergman, author of Eco-Design,
Sustainable Design,
A Critical Guide, which is also a general guide. I highly recommend that you get a copy. I think it's really good for all interested lay people. And for those of you, our younger colleagues, perhaps eventually there'll be an e-edition or something that we can...
I'm pushing.
That we can more readily access.
Great.
This has been Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.